please the court. I've reserved 3 minutes for rebuttal, Judge Shadle. Your Honor, the facts are fairly uncomplicated, we submit, that there's no evidence in the record that any of the appellants supervise a criminally responsible participant. There's no, Judge Lambert did not make a finding, contrary to the government's suggestion in their brief, that any of the defendants recruited anybody. In fact, Mr. Hunter, for example, was described by the case agent as a mere employee. The record reflects that it is, while Mr. Hunter and Mr. Chu certainly suggested the use of the UCC process, the Bill of Exchange process, as it was called, that doesn't qualify one for a Section 1B1 or Section 3B1.1 enhancement for role in the offense. Merely suggesting the means is not the same thing as controlling participants in a scheme or recruiting participants in the scheme. And to that effect, the fact that none of the defendants recruited any criminally responsible participant immediately separates this case from the government's principal authority called United States versus App out of the 10th Circuit. So I suggest to you that what we have here is a case of clear procedural error, and that this really serious issue in this case is what to do about it. Now, the government, in its brief, said absolutely nothing about harmless error. So the court could conclude that they've waived that argument and that having elected to stand on the merits.
Our circuit's approach to what to do in that instance is a bit muddled, wouldn't you say, the Price case? But it seems as if that's not an impediment to us considering.
Well, I certainly agree if the court could consider it unilaterally, but even then, the findings should come down in our favor. Let me give you some suggestions why, Judge Griffin. First of all, there's no degree of high confidence, I think, that the court could have that Judge Lambert would retain the same sentence on remand. Some things of food for thought. First of all, he didn't say on the record he would impose the same sentence irrespective if there were any procedural error. And I think any error in his calculation of a guideline.
Remind me what the numbers would be here. Had he calculated it appropriately according to your argument, what would the sentence
be? I think the numbers would have been a 43 as had he calculated it appropriately. But in terms of what he actually...
And at 43 with the criminal history category of 1, what's
would
the
have
range?
Been life. It would have been life. And what he did was he viewed this conduct, Judge Griffith, he viewed the conduct as worthy of 10 years. Now, if you look at the guidelines table, 10 years...
Yeah, I'm missing it. How's that helping you so far?
Because he thought that the loss figures were inflated, that if the loss figures, as is so often the case in these types of... in a situation where you have fictitious instruments, he thought the loss figures were artificially inflated. And what he came down with, what he decided was that the conduct reflected behavior, aberrant behavior of three men. I'm separating ourselves out from Mr. Kane. Three men, all in their 50s. Actually, Mr. Tangway, a decorated Vietnam vet, was in his 60s by then. Criminal history 1, no prior history. Religious men, family men. Judge Lambert pointed that out at sentencing. He viewed the conduct as worthy of 10 years. If one looks at the guidelines, 10 years is level 32. That's 121 to 151 months. If one takes off 3 points, if we're right, if a court concludes that we are correct, that this role in the offense enhancement was wrong, and you take off 3 points from a level 32, which is, remember, that's 10 years at the low end, you come up with a level 29, and that's 87 to 108 months. So what you would have is a delta of 34 to 43 months. I suggest to you that Judge Lambert might well give the defendants somewhat of a lower sentence on remand, and the record does not suggest in any way, shape, or form that he would impose the same sentence on remand. And the fact of the matter is, if you start off with the wrong guidelines number, I think cases from Gall up to the Supreme Court's recent decision in Pew, which I hope I'm pronouncing it right, all say the same thing. That's procedural error. But if you start off with the wrong number, there's a high likelihood you're going to end up with the wrong number.
So on the question of starting out with the wrong number, one thing that confused me about this is that it appears that what should have happened is that the offenses should have been stacked. But it doesn't appear that that particular provision that provides for stacking was applied here. And just bear with me for a second, you probably already thought about this, but it looked like what happened was that Judge Lambert said, he took the potential sentence and halved it. But I don't know that he started at the right place, because under 5G1.1a, which is what everybody cited, the provision says that where the statutorily authorized maximum is less than the minimum of the applicable guideline range, the statutorily authorized maximum shall be the guideline sentence, which would have been the maximum for the mail fraud count. And that looks like where he started and then he halved it. But because we had multiple offenses, it looked like a different provision actually applies, which provides for stacking. And if you apply the correct provision that provides for stacking, the guideline is actually higher. So what that leads me to think is that if, in fact, you prevail here, and if, in fact, there would be a remand, and if, in fact, that, what appears to be methodological flaw, was corrected, there's a possibility that your client's sentences could, in fact, go up, because he might start at a higher place than he started with below. Do you follow what I'm saying? I know that's a lot.
We're comfortable with the reasoned discretion of Judge Lamberth on remand. We have nothing but admiration for Judge Lamberth, and we're comfortable that he'll do the right move on remand. The key issue here, and you may well be right, Judge Funabas, nobody briefed that issue. The key issue here is, what do we do with a role enhancement that the appellant say to you is clear procedural error? Unless the court could conclude, sitting here today or in the sanctity of its own chambers, that Judge Lamberth would reach the same result down the line, then the court should remand, because the court would have no clear confidence.
And what's the standard we use to determine that? Is it beyond a reasonable – we have to be beyond a reasonable doubt that he would reach a different? Or what's the standard?
No, actually not, Your Honor. I think the standard is that you would have – do you feel a clear level of comfort that Judge Lamberth would reach the same level – actually, it's a high probability that Judge Lamberth would reach the same decision on remand. Could I suggest to you a case that I did some research yesterday – and because nobody had briefed the harmless error issue, but I think it's a useful case, even though it's out of a sister circuit, called United States versus Lankford, and the site is 516 Fed 3rd 205. It's a beautifully written decision. There is a dissent, but it's a beautifully written decision that talks about what one should do under these circumstances.
Which circuit?
Third circuit, Your Honor. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time.
You can finish your sentence. You can use up. Just go ahead. You can keep going.
I may sit down, Your Honor?
Yes, keep going. No, you can continue.
Oh, I can continue.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you still have a few minutes.
I'm a bit hard of hearing, so...
You still have a few minutes.
I think the Judge Lamberth might well give a lower sentence on remand, and if I could make a representation to the court, Mr. Hunter, his institutional counsel, wrote us a letter, for example, and said he has an outstanding work record and is looked upon as a mediator with the other inmates. Judge Lamberth, I think, might want to consider that under Pepper versus United States. So we asked the court to remand the case to Judge Lamberth. And I submit.
Anything else, Chief? Okay. Thank you.
May it please the court, Mark Detterman for the United States. I believe in this case that any error, if there was any, did not affect the district court's ultimate selection of a final sentence and was therefore harmless.
Well, you don't raise that in your brief.
We did not raise that specifically.
Generally, I mean, it's not raised, is it?
Well, I think as to their argument that we discussed about the extent of their downward departure, we sort of made an argument that it didn't matter because of the extent of the downward departure that they got. They made numerous sentencing arguments, and we did not try to calculate the guidelines to show harmlessness as to each of their sentencing guidelines.
By starting at this point with harmless error, are you conceding then that this enhancement was procedurally flawed?
No, Your Honor, we are not conceding that.
Oh. Well, what's your argument as to why?
Why don't you start with that? Yeah.
Okay. Although the district court's findings were a little bit weak. I mean, he found that the defendants had directed other staff to create false documents. But this court can find on the record that those other staff members were participants and that they were managed by Hunter True and Tangway.
Not the question. The question isn't whether the defendants managed them, but whether they, quote, shared criminal responsibility. That's our standard. In fact, your whole brief focuses on the behavior of the defendants. And the question here isn't their behavior. I mean, it isn't their criminal culpability. but rather whether the individuals they supervised, quote, shared criminal responsibility. Do you agree with that? That's the question?
I agree that that is one of the questions.
What's the other question?
Well, the other question I thought was under Quigley, whether they were actually managed. You're apparently saying that's not an issue here.
I'm not saying it's not an issue. Obviously, you're right. They do have to be managed.
Yeah.
But they also have to share criminal responsibility.
I agree.
And your brief doesn't really explain that. All I found in your brief was that the defendants were criminally culpable.
Okay. But on the record, there is evidence to show that there were six employees that testified at trial. They each admitted that when they came to the job, they were told that they were going to be paid cash under the table. And so that's first a red flag. If you're working an office job, you're paying cash under the table. The next thing is they were using false names. On the payroll, they were told they had to use a false name, and they had to make up a false name. I believe one of the Hello Kitty was one of the employees that testified that was her name on the payroll sheets that she used.
Now, was this in the sentencing memorandum that was presented to the district court on the reasons for applying this provision?
Yes, I believe it was, yes. I don't think we specifically talked about Hello Kitty, but we did talk in our brief that the false names were used on the payroll sheets. The other fact is that simply the six employees that testified all testified that they were clerical employees and that they were told to print out basically false checks. And I think that it's not clearly erroneous to find that an individual that simply on a computer printing out checks for millions of dollars has criminal responsibility, that it was that they knew what they were doing was wrong. And one employee, the receptionist, testified that she realized it was a scam, and finally she decided to quit the job because she was worried about the situation. And so I think the fact that those facts, paid in cash under the table, false names on the payrolls, and simply printing fake checks, I don't think anyone can think that it's not illegal to print out false checks and mail them to the IRS, simply printing out checks at an office and sending them to the IRS. Finally, several of the employees said that they knew that there was a civil injunction against the operation of the business and that the business had continued to operate. And again, that shows just a knowledge of these employees, and these were clerical employees. They all testified positions were like assistant, administrative assistant, or some of them said their jobs were just filing, printing documents, and shredding documents, and that's all they did. And there's also an additional employee, and that was a co-conspirator, Williamson. And although in his plea agreement, he was basically a salesperson that went out and sold these items, sold the products to people. And thus, I'd say he was under the management of these defendants who created the plan and created the step-by-step approach that they used to sell the plan to people.
Why wasn't any of this in your brief, if this is what you're now relying on?
Well, I think some of it is that they raised a lot of issues, and I think some of this is in our brief, but they made 10 pages of argument or so in their reply brief that we did not get to respond to. If we had responded to that, more of this would have been in our brief. I mean,
this argument was in their opening brief, too.
This argument, and I think we addressed what they put in their opening brief in our response brief, but they had more in their reply brief. They had about 10 pages in their reply brief.
Did Judge Lamberth rely on these facts in sentencing?
Well, most of these facts I'm citing were in the government sentencing brief. Some of them are additional facts in the record that I'm...
Mr. Dederman, are you suggesting that that the defendant's argument that these individuals did not share criminal responsibilities waived because they didn't raise it in their brief? Is that what I heard you?
No, that's not my suggestion. I'm just saying that they highly...
That was the whole purpose of their brief. I mean, that's what they focused on.
I'm not suggesting that. I'm just saying that they highly bolstered that argument in almost 10 pages of reply brief and that. But I have to go back and look at our brief, but I think we at least made some argument in our brief about the use of cash and false names.
What makes it difficult for us is that, as I read it, there's no argument in your brief at all on the question of whether the participants were criminally responsible.
I guess that's because we thought the main issue was whether these three were managers, and that was, I took that to be their main argument. Yeah.
But that's clearly insufficient under the comments and under the case law, right? I mean,
to manage participants.
Right.
But there is a separate prong, though, that you can manage an otherwise extensive criminal enterprise under the guidelines.
But you have,
and so this would also fall under
the participants.
Is that right? I thought under the application notes, you have to manage at least one participant.
Yes, you have to manage at least one participant. That's correct.
So that it's not a completely independent ground to say that it's an elaborate enterprise. There still has to be management or supervision over one person.
That's correct. There has to be management of at least one person. But again, I think although the judge did not specifically find that the individuals being managed creating the false documents were criminally culpable, I think there is evidence on the record here to support that.
But don't we have to send it back? Then we can't make those findings, right?
I mean,
the district court makes the finding, and we review them for, you know, clear. We don't. Those aren't the kinds of findings we can make, are they?
I think this court can.
It sounds like you're making a harmless error argument now.
Well, I am making a harmless error argument. I think that's our strongest argument.
Which isn't in your brief.
These people were 43s, and this would have dropped them down to 40, which is 292 to 365 months, and that wouldn't have made a difference in the ultimate 120-month sentence. As you noted, it appears the judge took 20 years to be the maximum, Your Honor, and based on concurrent sentencing, and then split that in half. And any technical error he made regarding whether the participants were criminally culpable, that didn't make a difference to his ultimate 120-month sentence. That was based on the totality that he saw of their conduct.
It doesn't sound like it would be too difficult to fix any problems with this on remand, is it? I mean, there is a line of thought that we wouldn't take something up like this sua sponte if it's going to cause huge problems in the district court level, but the way you're describing it doesn't sound like this would be that difficult for the district court to handle on a remand.
I agree. I don't think it would be very difficult for the district court to handle a remand.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Does Mr. Lecker have any time left? Go ahead.
Judge Tatel, I think your question of a government kind of tells us the real answer here. The appellate court should not be in a position of having to weigh facts and decide facts that the district court failed to make.
And he's just told us it wouldn't be a great burden on the district court either, right?
But it's very clear, the facts are very clear, that that our clients did not manage any criminally responsible participants. Again, as the case agent, who's certainly familiar with the case, said, Stephen Hunter, my client, was a mere employee. Menzies, the receptionist, didn't testify that she knew had any way, shape, or form that she was engaged in.
Let's get away from the management side. What about the criminally responsible side? Government counsel has said they use false names, there's money being passed under the table. How do you respond to that?
That's not evidence that the employees knew they were engaged in a scheme to obstruct the IRS. That's what some of the clients were convicted of. That it's evidence that the employee's taking cash under the table, not to be desired. You're cheating the IRS, but that's not engaging in a scheme that was defined as our client's complicity, which was obstructing the IRS. And that,
the use of false names, false checks, wouldn't they be on notice that something amiss is going on here?
Something amiss, perhaps, but these people weren't managers. There's nothing in the record to show that Stephen Hunter was managing anybody.
Because you're back on the management side now.
But to be a leader or a supervisor, you have to have both.
You've got to be managing someone who's criminally responsible. Have you just given up on the criminally responsible side? It sounds like you have.
What I'm saying to you is there's nothing in the record to suggest that any of the appellants were responsible for overseeing the activities of criminally responsible people. Hunter, there's nothing to that effect. Danny Chu, nothing to that effect. The only one is there, even a suggestion, and the record there is muddied, is to Alan Tangway, where he said, are you the office manager? He says, yes, and later he said, well, no, I wasn't. Other people handled that. So if there is evidence to be dealt with, it should be dealt at district court level.
All right. Anything else? No. Thank you, gentlemen. Case is submitted.